Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. I used to wonder about this one line that Iggy Pop sang in his song Dum Dum Boys. It's at the end of the song and it goes, "Now I'm searching for the Dum Dum Boys. The walls close in and I need some noise." What kind of noise, I wondered. What kind of noise could fight that feeling of claustrophobia that he's singing about? Well, this was the late 70s when the so-called industrial music scene first began forming, so maybe Iggy was thinking of some of those bands that really did blur the boundary between music and noise. Now, a new book charts the rise and splintering and lingering effect of the industrial music scene, which included this band, Throbbing Gristle. It's a pretty fascinating story, and we'll meet the book's author in just a bit. We've also got live music by Father Figures, a New York jazz combo, from NPR's Tiny Desk concert series. But first, comedian Hannibal Buress joins us in the Soundcheck studio. Hannibal is having a moment, maybe several of them. He's just signed a deal with Comedy Central, and Hannibal Fuse is doing this thing, Talking to Strangers. Tell us what that is.
That's just it's a web series where I interview musicians.
Just musicians?
Yeah.
So was music ever like a possible career path for you?
No, I'm not that good at it. I played the saxophone in grade school, like third or fourth grade, but I stopped after that. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't think I would have a future in music. I like messing around with it and having fun. I love going to shows and watching people and learning from music, but I don't think I could do it as a career. Yeah.
So Talking to Strangers will air starting in late in July.
Yeah.
On Fuse's YouTube channel.
Yes.
And here's Hannibal Buress talking with the drummer, DJ, and record producer Questlove of The Roots in the first episode of Talking to Strangers.
Besides me, who is your favorite comedian that's appeared on Fallon?
You are one of my favorite comedians on Fallon.
Oh, thanks, man.
You realize that, right? I think the hardest I ever laughed at a comedian unexpectedly was Amy Schumer. And now I work for her. So
you work for her?
It comes full circle.
Are you on her?
I gotta work for everybody. Like, that's my whole thing, is like, what job can I do?
Yeah, you got lots of jobs, man.
I produce records, I score,
yeah,
TV and film. I'm opening a restaurant. There's the hoodie shop. I teach at NYU.
So you don't just have downtime, really.
You know, they do that intervention thing where they sit you down and tell you, like, you gotta stop smoking heroin or crack or whatever. Like, I have an intervention team that makes me not take work. Self-imposed vacations.
You don't get pedicures?
Yeah, I'm getting all that.
I hadn't gotten a pedicure before, but I got one while I was in Mexico on vacation, and it was nice. It tickles.
There is no shame.
Hannibal Buress with Questlove, the drummer and DJ and record producer from Hannibal's forthcoming series, Talking to Strangers. You got a pedicure in Mexico?
Yeah, I did. Mm. It was great.
Okay.
I was just, you know, I got to take better care of my feet. I think as men, we worry that we think that pedicures are feminine.
Mm.
But you should just get your feet taken care of. I haven't had one in a couple months, actually. I need to get it again. I think part of the reason why I was hesitant to get one was because my feet are in such horrible shape that I didn't want to put anybody...
You want to talk about... I play soccer on Sundays. I never have all 10 toenails at any one time. So it's just like my toenails are gross.
Yeah, I feel like I should have a pre-pedicure before the real pedicure. My feet need to be prepped.
All right. I don't know how we got off on that. I don't know how you got off on that. I mean, one minute you're talking to Questlove about
you know, being a workaholic. Next minute, pedicures.
Yeah, my interviews really don't have a through line or an arc. It's very... Also, that was my first interview ever. That was my first time interviewing anybody, and I think I'm bad at it. Just because I'm so used to being interviewed from through my career, so every time I interviewed, when I would ask somebody a question, then they would have an answer, and then I would say how it related to me, just because I'm so used to just talking about myself. It's messed up.
It's very different to be on the other side of the microphone, isn't it?
And so you have to be able to engage, and it's tough, so hopefully I'll get better at it, but luckily Fuse is willing to take a chance.
All right, Hannibal Buress is with us on Soundcheck, former writer for 30 Rock and SNL. His new series for Fuse is called Talking to Strangers, debuts in July. And, you know, speaking of you and music, I mean, music, especially rap, has been kind of a recurring theme in a lot of your stand-up work.
Yeah, one of my first few jokes when it was 2002, Nelly had the song E.I., and he had I like talking about rap lyrics and just hearing stuff and questioning them. Nelly had a line where he said, "I'm a sucker for cornrows and manicured toes." And, you know,
so we're back to pedicures again.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's like, no, women get that. You can't get your toes manicured. Women get their toes pedicured.
Yeah, yeah.
But so I like talking about lyrics and just what's going on in rap music. And it's a fun thing to do for me.
In one of Hannibal's stand-up routines, he says, "I feel like rap affects how I talk with people too much." Here's an example.
I feel like rap affects how I talk with people too much. It's not good. I was talking with my mom on the phone, and she was telling me, "Hannibal, so I'm watching your niece and nephew for a week while your sister is gone." And I'm like, "For a week, Ma? You watching for a whole week? Are they paying you to watch it for a week? That's a long time. You getting paid?" She said, "No, Hannibal, a grandmother doesn't have to get paid to watch her grandkids." I said, "Yo, Ma, money over everything."
Money over everything. I'm all about the cash flow. Cause rappers nowadays ain't got a clue like Hasbro. Never been half broke. Cause I stay full rich and I can get you.
So, Hannibal, do you have to know Lil Wayne to get the punchline of that bit?
No, you don't have to know Lil Wayne. You just have to know rap, and money over everything is something that dozens of rappers have said in songs and had songs titles said. So if you know rap, you know that money over everything is a trope.
So that is sort of mining that body of work. You get punchlines, you get material from rap.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just like when I do my headlining set, I have a section where it's just about different rap lyrics, where I have my DJ play snippets, and I'll comment on it. He'll play different things. So because you can, like I did in the bit that's going to play later, the Young Jeezy bit, where I'm just talking about the song, and it still works, but I find it's more fun to have the actual song there where people can hear it. Because I like to do rap jokes in a way that people that don't even know the artist or don't listen to rap, that they can still get that joke, where it's not that isolated.
Now, so if you're doing that, I mean, this is purely a kind of logistical question, but don't you have to, like, pay royalties if you're in a club and your DJ is playing bits of the actual rap that you're sort of riffing on? And...
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And I don't like being confronted about it in such a public way. I might get some emails from Rick Ross.
I think Hannibal Buress has a phone call to make. So why don't we, while he does that, listen to this. This is his bit about the rapper Young Jeezy.
This is rapper Young Jeezy. He has a song where he says, "How stupid, dumb, big, my room's got rooms." Nah, Jeezy, those are closets. Those aren't extra rooms in your rooms. Jeezy, he'd be the worst real estate agent ever. Right here we have a 34-bedroom house. Let me show you around the property. Great feature, this place. Some of the rooms have extra smaller rooms in them.
Hannibal Buress, my guest on Soundcheck, and Young Jeezy, more recently Odd Future has come in for a bit. So do comedy and rap, just as delivery mechanisms, do they have similarities?
What is rhythm involved? Yeah, definitely there's rhythm and pace and there's a lot of similarities. I go to rap shows all the time to just learn performance tips and tips on and things, just learning how to engage the crowd and different things about working the stage. I go to rap shows all the time just to learn more about performing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there things that comedy can do or deliver that rap maybe tries to and doesn't do as well? I mean, can rap be... There have certainly been funny rappers.
Yeah, there have definitely been funny rappers. I think that's the difference with... I don't know. I mean, with comedy, you have to have people listening the whole time. It's more of a... It's more straight through, just a hour set or however long your set is. Well, rap, some people rap and do songs straight through, or some people rap... They might banter in between, mm-hmm. or they might tell a story that leads into the song, and then I saw her, and then the beat drops and stuff like that. That you could, I do like when you know in rappers that when the banter is good and it's able to, they kind of lead you into the song.
Right,
it's really cool. Yeah.
So, but comedy is more of a narrative thing, whereas if a rapper is being comic, it's often in short bursts, maybe because. I don't know. Sometimes it can be, especially with some of the faster rappers, it can be hard to get every word.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, that's one thing, too, where rap, you might not even... I've gone to shows where if you don't know the person's songs, you don't...
You don't really stand a chance, do you?
I mean, you stand a chance, but you can also see that somebody's doing well, even if you... It's something about rap where you can feel the energy and you can see their flow, and you're like, this person's good. I don't know what they're saying, but they're still good.
Yeah.
Or with comedy, you have to know what the person is saying for them to be good. But with rap, there's been times where they're killing it. It's because it's just energy. You can tell the flow, even if you can't hear the words, you can hear the flow and how they're syncing up with the beat.
Do you, do you study older comics? Are you familiar with John Cleese of Monty Python?
I'm familiar. I don't know his stuff that well.
He used to do a thing where he would just talk nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, in this very upper crust British accent. And he would like do it for like 40 seconds at a time.
Yeah.
You've done a kind of rap version of that.
Yeah.
How did this, is this sort of coming out of what you were just talking about?
Well, no, this was, it's a little bit of that where you it's just about having rhythm. But it was also just me, when I freestyle, and I freestyle rap with friends just hanging out. And sometimes I'll be on the beat, but then I won't have any words. So I'll just, to keep the beat, I'll just start, I'll just gibber to stay along with the beat. And so my friend Tony Trim, he was putting together just a mixtape of the beats that he liked. And I was talking over, I was hosting the mixtape. And so I this beat came on and I started rapping to it and then just started gibbering to it. And then... it was fun, and then we listened to it. We listened to it again, and it was really short, and it was kind of catchy, even though it was really dumb. And so I said, let's add some ad-libs to it. Ad-libs when you listen to the track and put in stuff like, yeah, what? Just that different stuff to punctuate the lines. And then we put it online, and it got a lot of hits, and Real Music Blogs picked it up. The Fader picked it up, and then I started doing it live. But I was kind of... nervous about doing a song live because it's a really bad song, and so I would just bring other things on, people on stage to kind of cover up for. I would try to cover up that the song was bad with production. So I would have the first time I did a song, I would have ballerinas, and then I would start bringing costume characters. I would hire people in different cities dressed up as Mario or
Super Mario.
Alvin from Alvin and the Chipmunks, just all this stuff going on stage I did my song.
And didn't you have Skrillex DJing for you at one point?
Yeah, well, that was for the YouTube, the big comedy show. They wanted me to close the show with gibberish rap, and they said, what do you want? I said, I want fireworks, I want a DJ, I want... I got Ryan Phillippe to be my hype man, and I said, I want to wear shiny suits like Puffy and Mace did in the late 90s. And they got it all together, and somehow they got Skrillex to do it and DJ. It was a lot of fun. It was fun to take just seeing how far you could take a dumb freestyle I did in my friend's bedroom.
This is Hannibal Buress with Gibberish Rap.
Yo, I'm in a booth right now. It's not a booth. To be honest about this whole recording situation, we in Carroll Gardens in one of Tony Trim's friend's bedroom. He's in the living room. He's working on, he's studying for law school and stuff. He's a good dude for letting us record here. Yeah. I ain't got no shoes on, I'm comfortable. Got a bass in my left hand. Yeah, I ain't got no pen, no paper. I'm just rapping. Rapping, rap, rap, rapping, rap. I'm rapping, rap, rap, rapping, rap. In my socks, rapping. These jeans, the crease. Put on deodorant. So the water fit. Put it in the water fit. Sugar is rap, finish. Coming with it, it's a bit of shit. But it was it. Coming through, it's bitter, it's bitter, it's killing a bit. Chicken with it.
A little bit of gibberish rap from my guest, Hannibal Buress. You know,
your show is better than that, man. That shouldn't be on your show. You really just brought your show down.
No, no, no. You know what I was just thinking. You know, there's always when in rap as in comedy. You were talking before about rhythm. It's like, mm-hmm. Where's the one?
Yeah,
Where's the one in that? That's not like a 4-4 thing, man. It's like a weird kind of 7 going on there. So the fact that you were able to do anything rhythmic with that is pretty impressive.
It was fun, man. It was fun.
Just like a little bedroom loop.
Yeah.
That you started.
I do the song when I perform the song. You remember how Jay-Z and Kanye would do that song, Niggas in Paris? They would do it 9 times. So to make fun of that, I do that song 5 or 6 times in my show.
Hannibal Buress' shows taking place at Caroline's Thursday through Saturday, June 27th through June 29th. Hannibal's with me on Soundcheck today. So what have you been listening to lately?
Lately, I got the J. Cole. I got that. Chance the Rapper, a rapper from Chicago. I got the new Thundercat put out an album. I think it's called Apocalypse. I'm not sure. But Thundercat's album's really smooth. It's a lot of good stuff. It's a song called Tron Song, and it's about his cat.
Well, people will know Thundercat from his work with Flying Lotus from a couple of years ago as well.
Yeah, Flying Lotus produced most of the album. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a really good album.
And you apparently have a favorite T-shirt for the rapper Dessa, which has provoked some confusion when you wear it.
Yeah, Dessa from the Doomtree crew in Minneapolis. I bought one of her shirts when I saw them in San Francisco a few years ago. It's a really good shirt. It's her face, black and white, and it's a real nice design. But people always think it's Prince whenever I wear it. People, is that Prince? Like, no. Who is it? Oh, it's Dessa. It's Dessa's rapper for many. So it's good promo for Dessa because I always got to explain who Dessa is to people wherever I go.
Does she look like Prince? At least
no,
on the shirt?
No, it's just how the drawing is really well done and seems. It's just a really nice drawing. I guess maybe she does look like Prince. I never thought that, but some people see that.
All right. Hannibal Buress performing at Caroline's Thursday through Saturday, the 27th through the 29th. His new series for Fuse, the online series Talking to Strangers, debuts in July. Hannibal, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Back to the wall, back to the pool, back to the drawing board. Back to the wall, back to the pool, back to the drawing board. Back to the wall, back to the pool, back to the drawing board.
There was a snowstorm in Jackson when you and I met at a club called St. Sebastian's. But the sign said something different. I remember thinking that I didn't have a shot at Mississippi television. Told us which roads they were closing. There goes a rap show. Everybody
in the background, that's the artist Hannibal mentioned a moment ago, Dessa, a member of the Minneapolis hip-hop collective Doomtree. Minneapolis is where the Brooklyn band A Great Big Pile of Leaves made their new album, which is streaming all this week at soundcheck.org. Our producer Greta Cohn talks with the band next. And later, the legacy of industrial music, from its murky beginnings in post-punk to the breakout success of Nine Inch Nails to its distant echoes in the new Kanye West record. That's coming up. This is Soundcheck.
Soundcheck, I'm producer Greta Cohn. Each week or so, we bring you an exclusive full album stream from an artist we think you need to hear before the record comes out. This week, we're streaming the brand new full-length from the Brooklyn-based band A Great Big Pile of Leaves. It's called You're Always on My Mind. A Great Big Pile of Leaves is a new band for most of us here on Soundcheck. So we did what we do when we meet a band for the first time. We asked them to fill out our Soundcheck blind date questionnaire. Drummer Tyler Soucy did the honors, and he is on the line with me. Hey, Tyler, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We asked you to describe your music in three words or less, and you said summer nights. Explain that to me.
We've always been pretty big fans of those records that you would listen to during high school summer break, and you remember those, I think, as you're growing up, or at least I do when I'm driving around in the summer. So I think we tried to encapsulate that a little bit in our music.
Where did the summer go? Where did the summer go? I'm gonna do it different. I'm gonna start over. I'm gonna plan. I'm gonna take some notes. Where did the summer go? Where did the summer go?
When you think of, like, this soundtrack to your summer nights, you know, what are some of the bands that come to mind?
The second Brand New album. That was, I think that was my peak of music in high school. So I remember that record a lot, driving around. I also listened to a lot of pop punk when I was really young. So probably a lot of stuff like Newfound Glory.
We've talked a lot on Soundcheck about how the music that you listen to when you're in that sort of like junior high and high school age is the stuff that really sticks with you and impacts a lot of the musical choices you make later on. And it sounds to me like that's really influenced this new record from A Great Big Pile of Leaves.
Oh, for sure. I mean, for me, I was in love with 90s pop alternative rock music. So I kind of got back into that stuff maybe like a few years ago. And I think it was the same way for a few of the other guys in the band, like getting back into Weezer and getting back into the late 90s emo music. The early, like, Third Eye Blind record, American Football and stuff like that.
On our questionnaire, we asked you who your first musical crush was, and you just mentioned Third Eye Blind. And you also mentioned Boys to Men. Tell me a little bit about that particular musical crush.
I remember getting Boys to Men on cassette, and me and a couple of my friends knew all the words, and I think we had a treehouse, and we would, for some reason, like, sing along to the songs, and we all had our different parts.
Do you remember any of the songs in particular from that cassette that you sang along to?
Probably the I'll Make Love to You song, which is probably weird for a bunch of, like, 10-year-olds to be singing together in a treehouse, but it happened.
Not so weird for 10-year-olds in a treehouse are slumber parties, school, snacks, all of which are on your new record.
Snack Attack, it's the first song on our record. It's probably my favorite song on the record. And I think it was the last song we really wrote for the record. Pete sent me the demo with the vocals on it, like, maybe a few days before we left for the studio. And he said he wasn't sure how he had felt about it. But, I mean, the chorus, to me, is one of the strongest on the record, and I think the song came together really well in the studio.
Late at night, you and I, never work out quite right. This is Soundcheck producer Greta Cohen, and I'm talking with Tyler Soucy from the band A Great Big Pile of Leaves. Their upcoming album is streaming all this week in our check ahead on soundcheck.org. Getting back to our Soundcheck questionnaire, I wanted to wrap things up with this question. I loved your answer to, if you could be any musician for a day, who would it be and why? You said Mick Jagger.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, I would also love to be a career musician who's playing with the same band however many years they've been playing together. I think that's really awesome. And he has probably gotten even better as a frontman. I think that's pretty inspiring.
And you're a drummer and maybe you secretly want to be up front?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that too. Yeah, I think all drummers, we sit in the back all day, so it's nice to dream at least about being up front.
That was Soundcheck producer Greta Cohn talking with Tyler Soucy of the band A Great Big Pile of Leaves. You can stream the band's entire new album, You're Always on My Mind, all this week at soundcheck.org. Up next, inside a new book that charts the history of industrial music, this is Soundcheck. On sight. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Almost as soon as they got their hands on it, critics started talking about the more industrial aspects of this new Kanye West record. What did they mean by that? Well, so-called industrial music is that loud, sometimes abrasive genre that came out of the post-punk movement of the mid-70s. And brought about cult bands like Throbbing Gristle and Cabaret Voltaire, as well as more mainstream acts, eventually, like Nine Inch Nails. Author and composer S. Alexander Reed has recently published a history of the genre. It's called Assimilate, A Critical History of Industrial Music. Alex, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much, John.
So, where did industrial music come from? I mean, let's define our musical terms here.
Sure. Industrial music, in terms of where it comes from, starts off in a few different places, all interestingly more or less at the same time. You can find its origins in northern England, you can find its origins in Berlin, and you can find its origins in San Francisco and a few other key places. But in each of these cases, it's reacting to the urban environment around it. And that's chiefly because it is a music that is invested in figuring out what controls us in our daily lives, whether that's the city or technology or commerce, and then using the sounds and the signs of that stuff as a weapon against those controlling forces. So
So genuinely industrial sounds.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, using tape recording technology to record things like, you know, factory noises.
For sure. You mentioned Cabaret Voltaire, and the guys in Cabaret Voltaire, Chris Watson especially, used to drive around Sheffield and use a tape recorder to record the sounds of factories and mm-hmm. the sounds of cars going by, and then they would actually broadcast it from speakers mounted on top of their van in the hopes of confusing the urban experience and revealing to everyone just how noisy and how industrialized their daily lives were.
Now, so that almost sounds like performance art, which a lot of the early industrial bands, they almost were like performance artists. There's an evolution that takes place. I think most people now, when they hear the word industrial, they think of bands like Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor.
Right.
And maybe we can talk about how we get to that stage eventually, but is Trent Reznor, is Nine Inch Nails the kind of the flag bearer for industrial music, for better or worse?
Sure. We can say yes.
Because you sound like you don't want to say yes. But.
Well, I mean, genre is defined by not just the bands themselves or not just by me, but it's defined by all the fans as well and mm-hmm. by the media. And so if people call it industrial, then there's only so much choice that you can have in the matter.
So this is the sort of the mainstream version of industrial music, we
Absolutely.
Say.
And what's interesting is that in the early 1980s, though it started starts off as this very noisy, rhythmless, sort of swampy sounding music, they started putting in dance beats into this music, and it starts off as like a send-up, a mockery of disco music or of rock music, but it didn't take long before they started saying, hey, this feels pretty good to play this guitar, or this feels pretty good to dance, and so what might have been some kind of political commentary on the mass-produced nature of pop music turns into a genuine pleasure that people are taking as musicians and as fans in this music.
This is Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails. They have a new single called Came Back Haunted. It was released earlier this month. First single from the album Hesitation Marks, which will be released in September. Came Back Haunted is the new single from Trent Reznor and the band Nine Inch Nails, which for many years has been kind of the visible face of the industrial music movement, the music genre that is the subject of S. Alexander Reed's book Assimilate, A Critical History of Industrial Music. You were speaking a moment ago, Alex, about how industrial music, this kind of dark, swampy, as you put it, this kind of miasma of sound comes to evolve into industrial dance music, which is much more along the Nine Inch Nails vein of things. When does that happen? Is that mid-80s? Is that under the spell of new wave and, you know, electro clash and all the stuff that was happening then?
It certainly gets a lot of momentum in the mid-1980s. You can see the roots of it going back really to 1979. You mentioned Throbbing Gristle earlier. Throbbing Gristle is the band that nearly everyone points to as being the progenitors of industrial music. And they released this album called 20 Jazz Funk Greats. And I talked about sending up pop music.
Yeah.
A title like that is absolutely a send-up. Because, of course, it doesn't have 20 tracks, and they're not jazz, and it's not funk, and some would call it great. But that's basically a dance record.
From a band who, up to that point,
had only made
nothing
noise.
Like,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, their music before that was just... And then you'd get, you know, the lead singer, Genesis Peorge, mumbling about serial killers. And so you start seeing these sort of rhythmic ideas in the early 80s. And there's also a lot of permeability between genres at this point, because a lot of things are getting started. Synth pop is getting started. You have this whole legion of bands like the Human League and Depeche Mode at that time, who are called futurist bands, who are doing shows with industrial acts. And then you have post-punk bands. And so... there was a negotiation.
And the goth movement.
For sure, yeah. At the Batcave Club in London and things like that. I mean, there's a lot of negotiation of what these genres were going to be, and they were still kind of a murky group of styles. But as there was a lot of interchange between them, by the mid-1980s, not only do you get a lot more rhythmic and much more tonal musical ideas happening in industrial music, but you start seeing more verse-chorus structures.
Yeah.
And that's also an issue of people realizing that there's a little bit of money to be made and that, you know, there are crowds who want to see them, and so you have to put on a show, and so you have to start shouting instead of mumbling, and so you start getting bands like Nitzer Ebb and Front 242 and Ministry, and then of course 1989 Nine Inch Nails' first album comes out, and they together really formed this entire new school of industrial music, which is dance-oriented.
It's interesting you mentioned Ministry, because of course they came out of that new wave dance rock kind of thing.
For sure.
And then went more heavy and dark and into the industrial thing. If I were to ask you, Alex, to come up with, to name three essential industrial bands for listeners who, you know, just want to kind of get a sense of who the main players are, who would the first of those be?
Oh, it's tempting to say Throbbing Gristle, but I'll start off people with something a little bit more swallowable. The band that probably best assembles all of the ingredients of industrial music, from the noisy side to the dancey side to the melodic side to the harsher side, I would say Skinny Puppy. And this is a Canadian industrial group that gets started in 1982, and they're still around. They just put out another record. They really bring this aspect of the gothic into the music. They're very abject, they're very grimy and dirty, and their music always sounds like their lead singer, whose name is Ogre, is practically turning inside out. It's full of guts and grossness, and it's a really identifiable sound that I think nearly everyone from every side of the industrial scene at least likes a little bit of something by Skinny Puppy.
So this is a song called Warlock from that Canadian Vancouver-based band of long renown in the industrial music scene. Canadian band known as Skinny Puppy, longtime figures, major figures on the so-called industrial music scene. My guest is S. Alexander Reed here in the Soundcheck studio, visiting professor at NYU's Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music and author of the book Assimilate, A Critical History of Industrial Music. That title comes from Skinny Puppy, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Their big breakthrough single is a song called Assimilate, and it's one that you can still hear if you go out to industrial and goth clubs, you know, here in New York City at you know, any weekend of the year.
Mm-hmm. Does the song title have sort of a broader significance for you in the context of this book?
For sure. One of the things about industrial music is how heavily political it is and how interested in transgression it is and how much it pits itself against these supposed all-controlling forces, these hegemonies. Mm. And so it is concerned with, like I said earlier, using the tools of these forces against themselves, assimilating the evils of the world even as it is threatened by being assimilated by those evils.
So there's a kind of ambiguity here because, of course, among those forces are market forces.
Sure.
And, you know, you want to make a living. you referred to this before as, you know, as industrial gave way to industrial dance when bands realized, oh, there are people who want to see us. Mm-hmm. We need to put on shows. So the movement has had to kind of wrestle with its own, however limited, its own successes, too.
For sure. And it's not strictly an anti-capitalist, solely Marxist movement. It has all kinds of political extremes within it. And there have been a lot of ways that people have navigated that, some successfully, some less so. One interesting chapter is that in the early and mid-1990s, you mentioned Nine Inch Nails, when Nine Inch Nails really breaks through, all these major labels were saying, oh, we have to go get an industrial band. Mm. Let's go sign Skinny Puppy. That's what American Records did. Let's sign Front 242. That's what Sony did. And all these bands who had been underground successes in the 1980s got foisted out into the public. And actually, despite the fact that people were hoping that it would be the next big thing, it didn't quite catch on. There was about 10 minutes when it seemed like it would be in about 1994, 95. But most of these bands, it ended up harming them, in some cases irreparably. Skinny Puppy, for example, lost a member to a heroin overdose during that time.
All right, so I asked you for three essential industrial bands. Skinny Puppy first on your list. Who else?
I would go with the German band Einstürzende Neubauten. Mm-hmm. That's a German phrase that means collapsing new buildings in English, and they are very much a product of the Berlin scene of the late 1970s and early 1980s. And Berlin is this really interesting city at that time. You're having all these riots and leftist extremist movements because there were subventions for young people living in West Germany to go live in West Berlin with a stipend, basically, if they were students, and it would also absolve them of having to serve in the military. And so what it meant is that you had a hotbed of radicalism that, on one hand, West Germany was trying to shove in the faces of East Berlin to say, look at how artsy and wonderful our culture is. Don't you want to be like us? But on the other hand, it meant that they put all the anti-government people together in one place. And so they were squatting around in this city that had only, you know, 2 million people, but it was built for 5 million. And there is just this real strange sense of anarchism going on, and a sense that they couldn't trust their parents because their parents had been all complicit under the Third Reich. And so it was kind of a year zero moment for bands like Einstürzende Neubauten.
Whose early records really did consist of, you know, metal drums and tubes being banged around and stuff. They would eventually get into the industrial dance thing too. But what track have you chosen for us?
I've chosen a track called Seele Brennt. And while Skinny Puppy and other bands who do dance music are very electronic, Einstürzende Neubauten really does, as you say, have the sound of banging on the things in the room around them. It's the sound of banging on the empty spaces of Berlin, really. And so this is a song that has a lot of hand-based percussion. And interestingly, the timing of this song is all based around the physical pulse of the lead singer's body. And so
that's Blixabargeld.
Exactly, Blixabargeld.
Seele Brennt, Souls Burn, from the German band Einstürzende Neubauten. Meine Seele brennt, my soul burns, says Blixabargeld, leader of the band Einstürzende Neubauten, formed in West Berlin around 1980 and key players in the industrial music scene. Alex Reed with me here in the studio. You make the point that this thing that we've just heard eventually leads to Stomp, the family-friendly percussion troupe on Broadway and around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting if you look at how they were reappropriating the city around them, the barricades that were being used in these riots, the oil drums, the technology that had been abandoned after the Second World War, and banging on them to show everyone and to show themselves and to kind of abreact for themselves, this sense of emptiness and this sense of the shell of their world that had been left by this military-industrial complex. And so if you take the most surface-level element of that, banging on oil drums or breaking glass as a piece of percussion, that's something that's, you know, kind of cool and edgy that a lot of people can get into in the right context. And so part of the story of industrial music is continually how it's been reappropriated by other people. And you mentioned Kanye West earlier as a good example of people using elements from industrial music elsewhere.
And let's not forget that, you know, when Einstürzende Neubauten started playing, playing for them often meant destroying whatever space they were in. So it was, they were a hard band to book into your club.
Oh, for sure. When I saw them play a few years ago, they had a huge fire pit that they had microphones held up to. And so you had initially the sound of the fire, but then you had the sound of the microphones, you know, burning and melting as those microphones were destroyed. There's a lot of sense of transgression going on in industrial music as a sort of philosophical tenet. The idea being that if you break some rule that's unwritten, then you've revealed the rule and it's now written and everyone knows what they can fight against and who the enemy is.
Alex's book is called Assimilate, A Critical History of Industrial Music. All right, so Skinny Puppy, Ein Stürz in den Neubauten. You've already mentioned the band Front 242 a couple of times.
Sure.
They're the third of the troika, the three big bands that we should know?
That's what I'm saying today anyway. I think that Front 242 is a good example to use. They come out of this Belgian movement called EBM, Electronic Body Music, which gets started around 1984 or so. And unlike Skinny Puppy, which is dirty and messy and sort of drippy sounding, Front 242 and bands like them, like Nitzer Ebb, who are English, they're very obsessed with cleanliness and with impenetrability, and so it's almost a calisthenic kind of music, and it's very male, but not in any kind of traditional heteronormative way. And it's about the impregnability of the body, and it's about the strength of the individual, presumably against some sort of massive force. But as a result, you get these sort of clenched gut pronunciations of the lyrics. And it tends to have a very electronic, pure sound. Mm.
And while they do sing in German occasionally, many of their songs are in English.
Yeah, because they're Belgian, and actually a huge number of these EBM bands are coming out of Belgium. There was less of a sense of national identity than you got with the English bands or the American bands. When I spoke with some of the Belgian artists in this, they almost uniformly said, we really didn't have any sense of nationalism. We didn't have any sense of what it meant to be Belgian. And so they were just as happy to sing in French or even Dutch or German or English. And so you'll find some bands like Agrum, for example, using Spanish and French and English all in the same song.
Mm. Well, this song's in English. It's called Headhunter. Version 1.0 from Front 242. That is some industrial dance music, let's call it, from the band Front 242 out of Belgium. Headhunter is the song, and Alex, you mentioned EBM, electronic body music. That is definitely, you know, there's a very strong dance element to this, and it's important to kind of restate that that is as much a part of the industrial movement as the clanging and banging of Ein Stürz in den Neubauten that we heard just a few minutes ago.
It is functionally. What's interesting about the industrial scene, and this starts around 1985 when the dance element comes in, is there is a little bit of a factionalization. You do get some people who are these noise purists who only listen to what they call harsh noise wall music, for example, or power electronics, bands like White House. And then you get these people who are really heady and intellectual who only want to listen to the experimental end of things, like Häffler Trio. But in terms of the sheer proportions of the industrial scene and of people who call this music industrial, that's actually a pretty small percentage of it. I mean, if you go out to an event that's billed as an industrial music night, you're going to hear the dance stuff.
Right.
And that is the stuff that people have loved, and it's the stuff that has most influenced the world around us. And so as much as I have affection and respect for the really heady stuff It's important to recognize just how big a player the dance side of things is.
And so that's where Nine Inch Nails comes from. That's the when critics write all this week about the industrial aspects of the new Kanye West record. That's the sort of flavor of industrial music they're talking about as well. Where do you see industrial music in the 21st century? I mean, we've been talking about bands that came up in the 80s.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
What's the relevance of this today?
A few things. I mean, so after I mentioned this sort of big corporate boom in the 1990s when Nine Inch Nails was coming out and they were signing bands like Gravity Kills, after that happened, the whole sort of underground scene had to reinvent itself and had to sort of reimagine what it would mean to be industrial, because the future as it had been envisioned in the early 80s had happened, and it wasn't any better. In fact, it was just much more boring. So in the 21st century, around 2000, we get this whole very, very synth-pop driven element of the scene, what some people call future pop, but much more today. There's a lot of industrial influence in these sort of underground scenes, these sort of synth wave and witch house scenes that you see out in Brooklyn, for example. And they are in many cases reaching back to those early 80s bands like Coil and like Throbbing Gristle and almost imagining as if the previous two decades had never happened. They throw away the 90s, they throw away 2000 and 2005, and they sort of say, all right, let's go back to old drum machines, let's go back to external sound processors for our voice, and sort of reimagine a much more sort of hip-hop influenced version of this.
So Witch House.
Witch House would be one good example, yeah.
A species of hip-hop that has very kind of industrial kind of fundamental layer that it's built on.
Yeah, for sure. And for people listening, the visual thing to look out for here is the triangle, which has now become fashionably ubiquitous. If you see the sort of black filled-in triangle with or like inverted or regular crosses, triangles and crosses are the kind of visual
emblems.
Signal, yeah, of this stuff.
Give us an example of some witch house, the current, one of the current iterations of industrial music.
Sure. I think they'd probably object to calling it an iteration of industrial, but it's so much in the lineage. A band like Salem, for example, who really breaks in 2010 would be a good example. And there are other acts like maybe Creep, or I'm a huge fan of the band Light Asylum. And they all have actually a pretty different sound from one another, but they're all participating in the same kind of visual aesthetics and the same lineage and the same musical heritage.
So a style of music that grew up in the late 70s, still finding ways to be relevant today. That style is industrial music. And S. Alexander Reed, my guest here in the Soundcheck studio today, is author of the book Assimilate: A Critical History of Industrial Music. Alex, it's been very illuminating. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
That's the group Salem, one of the bands that Alex Reed talked about a moment ago, and that's the title track from their album King Knight from 2010. Join us tomorrow for a conversation with singer Kylie Minogue. She'll talk about her upcoming album and a new book that chronicles how the pop diva's look has evolved over her 25-year career. Later this week, we'll have some special folks sitting in for me while I take a few days off on Wednesday. Kurt Anderson of WNYC's Studio 360 will host the show. His guests will include the musician Andrew W.K. and the singer, model, and former First Lady of France, Carla Bruni. And singer-songwriter Erin McKeown has been writing a sports blog for soundcheck.org. On Thursday and Friday, she'll sit in the host seat with live performances from the jazz singer Cecile McLaurin-Salvant and the Handsome Family. Hope you'll join her for those later this week. We're going to leave you tonight with a Tiny Desk concert from NPR Music. This is the New York Jazz Quintet called Father Figures, recorded at the NPR offices in Washington, D.C. You can watch the whole thing right now at soundcheck.org. But here's a bit of Father Figures performing a piece called This Is the Way We Mean. That's the New York Jazz outfit Father Figures from a Tiny Desk concert recorded at NPR Music in Washington, D.C. Adam Schatz on sax and effects, Jas Walton on sax, Spencer Zahn on upright bass, Ian Chang on drums, Ross Edwards playing the keyboards. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, Jason Isaac, and Rick Kwan. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop with Alex Kappelman and our interns, Alex Martinez and Ian Petrarca. Our digital producer is Mike Katziff. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. See you back here at 9 tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.